All right, great. So, title of my talk, quantum groups and Lagrangian vibrations. Some parts of what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Olivier Schiffman. And it's all sort of work in progress. Hopefully something about this will appear on the archive soon though. So a brief overview of what I'm going to talk about. I guess there's kind of three topics. Two of them are in the title of the talk. So I'm going to say some general facts about holomorphic Lagrangian vibrations. And then I'm going to describe a method to relate these to quantum groups. And then finally, we're going to see some applications of these ideas to the study of enumerative geometry of certain holomorphic symplectic variety. Using what was discussed earlier in the talk. So let's just start with the main definition, which is fairly well studied in algebraic geometry. So here we have M, which is a symplectic variety. Generally, we're going to assume that it's smooth, and it has complex dimension 2n. And it also has a holomorphic symplectic form, which is a non-degenerate 2-0 form on M. And some of these varieties admit Lagrangian vibrations to base varieties which are half dimension. So a definition of a holomorphic Lagrangian vibration is going to be a proper map to a half-dimensional variety whose fibers are Lagrangian subvariants. And it's important for us that the map is actually proper. So sometimes a more general notion of this is understood where the fibers can be complex tori, but for us, they're actually going to be proper varieties. And the version of the Arnold-Liouville theorem in this context says that if the general fiber of such a map is smooth and connected, then it actually implies that the general fiber is an abelian variety, obviously of half dimension. And maybe one of the most important geometric notions that comes out of such a structure is that there is a divisor over the base B, so a codimension, complex codimension one subvariety sitting in the base, so that all of the singular fibers live over that divisor. So here we can see at a generic point, our fiber is a abelian variety, and over a specific point, it degenerates to a some sort of singular variety, despite the fact that the total space can be smooth. All right, so the main idea of this talk is to understand Lagrangian vibrations, and specifically the singular fibers of Lagrangian vibrations, using a concept that I'm going to call an intermediate symplectic singularity. So we start with our variety M on the last page with its map to a smooth base. And I guess one point that I didn't make is that we're always going to assume B is smooth. And maybe there are some like conditions that'll imply that it's smooth. Usually for us, it's actually going to be just an affine variety. There are some results that depend on the fact that it embeds into a projective variety so that we actually get a projective holomorphic symplectic variety. And it's contained as a piece of it for this talk. Right, so we can understand in this geometric context, we can understand some of the singular fibers by the fact that maybe some irreducible components of a given singular fiber are actually contractible. So we can factorize our Lagrangian fibration into a sequence of two steps, where our middle step is a singular symplectic variety. And these types of maps from a smooth symplectic variety to a singular one are usually called symplectic resolutions. Which is assumed to be a birational contraction morphism. So it's has proper fibers and it's generically one-to-one. So in this particular example where we have a degeneration of elliptic curve, we can see that one irreducible component of our singular fiber is a contraction of a minus two curve. And we can factor our map from this algebraic surface to, say, A1 or P1 into a map where first we contract the minus two curve and then we contract the entire surface. Now, it turns out that in general, to get what we want out of this concept of an intermediate symplectic singularity, we actually need something slightly more general. So that before we take our symplectic resolution, we first do a birational map of a particular form, and then we're able to contract maybe some locus in that birational model. So with the same setup of a holomorphic Lagrangian fibration, we're going to define an intermediate symplectic singularity to be a factorization, so that if we take this entire map, we recover our Lagrangian fibration, so that the first step is a birational map between two holomorphic symplectic varieties. So these are both symplectic, and then just a factorization like we had on the last page. So, and then we have a symplectic resolution followed by a contraction, so that the entire sequence factors in the category of varieties and birational maps between them. And a remark that, at least in the setup that I described above, that when our variety is some piece of a projective holomorphic symplectic variety, so that our base embeds into a projective space, so that our holomorphic symplectic form embeds over the entire proper variety, then we can produce these in quite great generality. So if our discriminant locus has various irreducible components, so here we have our base, and our discriminant locus is maybe some union of irreducible varieties. If for each of those varieties, its inverse image is such that it's not irreducible. So if we take a particular choice of an irreducible component of the discriminant locus, and we take its inverse image, so here's pi inverse of delta I, and maybe this is some union of two different components. Then each of those components turns out to be an exceptional divisor. So both D1 and D2 in this picture are prime exceptional divisors in the language of Markman. And in particular, there exists a contraction that contracts the entire divisor. And if you have maybe some subvariety lying inside that divisor, there may be other birational contractions that just contract those higher codimensional sets. So if we have a situation like this, or maybe we could deform our variety to a case where the inverse image of an irreducible component of the discriminant locus breaks, then we can study irreducible components of singular fibers by studying these intermediate symplectic singularities where there's a well-developed theory relating them, for example, to quantum groups. Okay, so now we're going to introduce our main example of a Lagrangian fibration that we're going to study using this method. So it starts with an elliptic surface. For example, the figure that I drew a few slides ago is an elliptic surface with a particular type of singular fiber. So we start with an elliptic surface, and then we have our elliptic surface over P1, but we let our fiber over infinity is going to be somewhat distinguished from the rest of the story. So in particular, we're going to pick a coherent sheaf living on that surface. And then we're going to take essentially moduli spaces of sheaves on S that are framed at this divisor. But it's not actually going to be sufficient just to take moduli spaces of sheaves. We actually need to take moduli spaces of objects in the derived category together with data with a framing at this divisor at infinity. There's a question.
Yeah, are there any constraints in the canonical bundle of S?
So in order to produce stability conditions, I'm not sure that's known in general for all surfaces, but since so most of these surfaces aren't going to actually be symplectic surfaces, but because A1 has a trivial canonical bundle and our elliptic fibration is always going to be relative trivial canonical bundle, we can push our singularities of our holomorphic symplectic form over infinity of P1 or over infinity on these moduli spaces, supposing that the moduli spaces themselves also emit Lagrangian fibrations. So
is it that these moduli spaces will themselves be symplectic because of the framing data?
Right, yeah. So for the cases we're going to consider today, yeah, so these moduli spaces end up being symplectic varieties over affine bases. So yeah, so the usual story of you have some unit pairing gives a symplectic form on the moduli spaces. We're going to get that the symplectic form on some open locus of the surface induces a symplectic form on those moduli spaces. And I'm not claiming that this is true for every possible choice of trim character and framing sheaf. I'm saying that all of the examples that we're going to cover today and the main examples can be described in this form. So for our main examples, we're going to take the Hilbert scheme of endpoints on the cotangent bundle of an elliptic curve. Then this actually emits a Lagrangian fibration. Or we're going to take elliptic surfaces and take Hilbert schemes of endpoints on those. These examples actually do have holomorphic symplectic forms, and they admit Lagrangian fibrations. So these particular examples arise from Here we're actually just going to take a example of Bridgeland stable moduli spaces where Bridgeland stability reduces to Giesecke stability, and we're going to take moduli of rank one with first trend character and second trend character framed at the trivial sheaf. In these other cases, we're going to take actually something quite similar. So we're also going to do MH delta 1 C1 CH2 of the infinity. And then for these cases, their birational models can be described in this way as moduli spaces of Bridgeland semi-stable objects. So I wouldn't worry too much about what this means about being sigma delta stable, but here delta is a positive real number, and this is a generalization of a notion of stability stability for framed sheaves. So it reduces to that in the case where on some derived equivalence frame, we actually get Giesecke, you know, torsion-free sheaves, and our notion of sigma delta stability reduces to framed Giesecke stability as described in various papers of Hubricks and Lane. Okay. So let's describe in more detail the specific interesting choices of surfaces S. So as is probably well known, the possible singular fibers of an elliptic surface admits an ADE classification. So Kadira gave a classification of all of them, and you have, they're all of type ADE, but for type A, there are a few different possibilities where even though the minus two curves that they degenerate to, their dual graph is the type A1, A0, A2 Dinkin diagram. They maybe have some more sophisticated structure than just transversally meeting in certain points. Further, we're going to get an even further constraint if we want to study equivariant, say, enumerative geometry, or we want our quantum group deformation parameter to lie in equivariant cohomology or equivariant K-theory of our moduli spaces. We need a group action on our surfaces that's going to induce a group action on moduli spaces. So while something can be said in more general cases, the most interesting things happen when we actually do get such a group action. So in particular, if we want an equivariant Lagrangian fibration over P1 so that C star H bar acts equivariantly on P1, then a particular implication of this is that the surface S is isotrivial. There's only two singular fibers. So I guess less than or equal to two, but we're only going to care about, I think maybe one is impossible, and so we're only going to care about zero and two. And it being isotrivial has this implication that the J invariant is constant. So we basically get two infinite families of examples and then three more examples. So our two infinite families that occur with any J invariant are when we have I0 star fibers. So we have a D4 at 0 and a D4 at infinity. So these work for any J. Your generic fiber is smooth. We can likewise just get E cross P1, where we don't have any singular fiber at all. And here, obviously, you also get any choice of J invariant. And then there are three other examples with specific choices of J invariant. And these occur when we have an E8 fiber on one side and a cusp on the other. Generic fiber is smooth. An E7 fiber over 0. This particular configuration of rational curves at infinity, or an E6 fiber over 0, this configuration at infinity. So these all only occur for a specific J invariant of your singular fiber. Okay. We want to understand, say, the Hilbert schemes of points on these surfaces and understand the singular fibers, Lagrangian fibrations using intermediate symplectic singularities. It turns out that all K-trivial birational models are moduli spaces of Bridgeland stable objects. So all birational models, all K-trivial, such that they're birational models living over AN. So we only really want to consider birational models that preserve the Lagrangian fibration. And all the K-trivial birational models are examples of these M sigma delta for a choice of churn character and a choice of frame. Just like Beyer and McCree proved in the case of Hilbert schema points on a K3 surface. We want to understand its birational geometry. We're going to understand certain cones of curves and dual cones of ample classes. We can describe them explicitly using some concrete description of what our exceptional curves are what are their dual cones in the class of Cartier divisors, relative over our base B. So here our base B in this case is A3. We can describe, for example, the Neff cone of the Hilbert scheme of three points on the cotangent bundle of an elliptic curve over the base. So the relative Neff cone is some particular chamber. This is the Neff cone of the Hilbert scheme of points. And maybe some other birational model, we're going to have a different cone, which is the Neff cone of one of these other moduli spaces. These walls can be understood by the usual Mori program by the fact that the walls are In an upper one, the space relative Cartier divisors are dual to the space of curves up to numerical equivalence. So the dual cone to the Neff cone for the Hilbert scheme of points is the Mori cone of curves in this space. So in this example, for n points, it's not so hard to describe what our two walls of the Neff cone are. So I guess first let's just describe what the axes are. So one axis is spanned by a curve, which is I'm going to call C2. And it's the curve traced out by a, if you have a pair of points that are non-reduced at the same point, the rotation of their structure sheaf traces out a P1. And this curve is dual to the exceptional divisor of the Hilbert-Chow map. So this wall of the Neff cone is the cone corresponding to the Hilbert-Chow. And then the other axis is spanned by a curve called CE. And CE traces out a E living inside or any numerical class of a curve of an elliptic curve in a smooth fiber, which is isomorphic to an abelian variety. So in particular, for the case of Hilbert scheme of points on an elliptic surface, it's the curve where you have one point on the elliptic curve and it traces out an elliptic curve as it moves around the elliptic curve. And then the other wall is C minus one over N. And this has a description as a P1 sitting inside the fiber of sim N of the elliptic curve, which maps under the Abel-Jacobi map to the elliptic curve itself, which fiber, its fibers are Pn. The symmetric power of an elliptic curve lives inside the Hilbert scheme, and the class of a P1 tracing out that Pn fiber is the other wall of the Neff cone. So in this case, we have n is equal to 3. And it turns out that that class is actually equal to the class of the elliptic curve minus 3 times the class of a curve which is exceptional for the Hilbert-Chow. Okay, and then the same story has a generalization for all of these other elliptic surfaces. I guess I had a slide in between here and there. So one way to understand this sort of this particular example directly from the work of Beyer McCree is to actually study a projective completion of your surface and understand particular neighborhoods of a boundary of the positive cone of the corresponding moduli space. So here we have a slice in the positive cone of Hilbert scheme of 4 points in a generic elliptic K3 with section. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a horosphere, which we can take to be an arbitrarily infinitesimally small sphere tangent to the boundary of the positive cone, or a slice in the positive cone. And then the Lorentzian metric on the positive cone for the projective holomorphic symplectic variety induces a Euclidean metric here. And the Lorentzian hyperplane arrangement, which is invariant under this Monodromy-Weyl group. So there's a Lorentzian-Weyl group, which is studied by Markman, Namakawa, in various different contexts. We have a hyperplane arrangement, which is you know, finite with respect to an actual Lorentzian-Weyl group. And the restriction to this Euclidean domain gives us an affine hyperplane arrangement, which is, you know, cofinite with an affine reflection group living in some negative semi-definite lattice. So the horosphere gives us this Euclidean hyperplane, and we get a affine hyperplane arrangement on that hyperplane. So we can think of this as maybe we're taking a projective surface or a projective holomorphic symplectic variety in the, with a Lagrangian fibration in the limit where our fiber tends to zero. So as we tend to the boundary of the positive cone, the ratio of the volume of our fiber tends to zero with respect to the volume of the projective surface, and then maybe we're going to take some open subset inside. So we can see various examples. So this is the case for the Hilbert scheme of 2 points on an elliptic surface with a single I2 fiber. So this is the picture that we had at the beginning, where we have one fiber of type I2 and the generic fiber is smooth. And we get this particular hyperplane arrangement on a slice. So so on this green slice or the horosphere, which looks like this, we get an affine hyperplane arrangement. Let's see. Our Neff cone for some birational model, well, actually, specifically the Neff cone for one choice of Hilbert scheme is this chamber. So this is the Neff cone of the Hilbert scheme of 2 points on the surface. So what happens if we you know, increase the number of points? So here's the corresponding thing for 3 points, 4 points, and 5 points. And we can see we kind of get this description of a double or maybe triple affine root system. And our walls correspond to roots in some sort of two or three loop Lie algebra or quantum group. So I guess I'll say a little bit more about this picture. So if you're familiar with quiver varieties, these regions should, and their limits and for smaller and larger n, should remind you of the Hilbert scheme of 5 points on the resolution of an A1 singularity. So in fact, the intermediate symplectic singularity corresponding to that face is actually precisely that singularity, and it's locally analytically modeled on that singularity. So we have an intermediate symplectic singularity. Which is the map from the Hilbert scheme of 5 points on a resolution of an A1 singular fiber to SIM5 of A2 modulo Z-mod 2, Z, which acts with the usual weights that it does to produce an A1 singularity. And it turns out that all of these singularities actually come from either finite or affine quivers. So the vertical walls correspond to Giesecke-Rolle-Limbeck maps, and where you have vertical and diagonal lines intersect, you get other symplectic singularities for affine singularity for affine A1 quivers with more sophisticated framing and dimension data for the ones that don't exactly correspond to the Hilbert scheme. So we're going to use this fact that associated to symplectic singularities, we can get some sort of quantum group in order to describe algebraic structures that act on these moduli spaces. So I'm kind of going to say things for both Borel-Mohr homology and for the K theory of these varieties, and we kind of get a different story for each of the two options. I guess it's an exercise to think about what happens for elliptic cohomology, but we're going to let H be a potentially extraordinary cohomology theory, potentially equivariant with respect to C star H, depending if such thing exists. And for each face in the cyberplane arrangement, where the phase of our object in the derived category overlaps with the phase of an object of corresponding to a real or imaginary root, we get something more general for positive roots. We get actions of quantum groups and Yangians on our moduli spaces of sheaves. So corresponding to real roots, which are associated to spherical objects in the derived category, we get actions of evaluation representations of affine quantum groups or actions of Yangians on the corresponding moduli spaces. Corresponding to imaginary roots, so imaginary roots in this case corresponds to all of our vertical walls in this particular example, which hopefully you see the generalization from the story to type higher ADE. We get an action of a quantum toroidal algebra, which is an evaluation on other parameters, or in cohomology, we just get an action of the Yangian. And at loci where you have higher codimension faces, where you are at the intersection of both real and imaginary walls, you get actions of quantum toroidal algebras of type ADE, or Yangians of the corresponding type. So for simplicity in our examples, so in particular for these Hilbert schemes, the only roots that you get are of real and imaginary type. In general, for general Lagrangian fibrations, this symplectic singularities correspond to more sophisticated things, maybe quivers with loops that aren't of finite or affine type. And you can say something about these cases, but complicates the presentation, and working out all the details is a work in progress. I said you get an action of all these quantum groups. So let's work out the example for isotropic roots. And this is a hopefully quite familiar story corresponding to like Heisenberg and quantum toroidal actions on Hilbert schemes of points, or on moduli spaces of higher rank sheaves where you modify along points. So in the quantum group picture, this is going to correspond to isotropic roots. And what we're going to do is we're going to pick a derived equivalence of our surface that sends an object in the derived category to just the structure sheaf of a point. So in the case where we're sitting inside of a K3 surface, this is a consequence of the derived Torelli theorem. For the elliptic surfaces that I listed above, it's well, there's a general result of Bridgeland about relative Fourier-Mackay transforms that'll always give you such a derived autoequivalence of your surface. And so you can pick this derived autoequivalence so that your moduli space of objects of that Chern character under the derived equivalence is isomorphic to your surface. Well, the framing actually implies that it, you're not allowed to get points at infinity. So your moduli space of unframed sheaves is the surface, and your moduli space of framed sheaves, because of the isomorphism requirement, is the surface without the divisor at infinity. And then we define a Heggett correspondence, which is parallels the usual story for the Hilbert scheme of points, and we get a line bundle over it, and we take an nth tensor power of the line bundle in convolution with this cycle induces an action of quantum toroidal algebra. So when n is equal to zero, this was understood by Nakajima and Baranovsky, and the claim in K theory, in the projectives case, is a result of Nagut, and the frame story is for the cotangent bundle to a curve was done by Alexander Ganes, this particular case is just really a mild generalization of this sort of story. So what we do is we take the usual convolution with respect to this diagram for all possible n in the case of K-theory, or for positive n in the case of ordinary cohomology. Then we take their adjoints and maybe some multiples of a diagonal, and we pull back specific classes in the K-theory of moduli spaces which are isomorphic to our surface moduli without the divisor at infinity. We have various versions depending on which choices of cohomology we take, whether we take just even cohomology, just algebraic cohomology. These generate an action of a quantum toroidal algebra on the cohomology of these moduli spaces. So because we have a framing, we actually have to worry quite a bit less about the primitivity of the Mackay vector, because the automorphism that comes from imprimitive Mackay vectors is handled by the fact that we get an isomorphism with a simple sheaf over infinity. So in this case, we're actually going to assume that F is simple. And the deferration parameters in K-theory are actually the Chern roots of the cotangent bundle of this moduli space. Okay, and obviously in cohomology, this line bundle isn't a cohomology class, and we have to take its Chern class in order to get an action. And then similar things can be said for real roots and for the intersection of real and imaginary roots that are generated by those algebras. So an important point is we can do these for these subalgebras, but our choice of Fourier-Mackay transform that got us there doesn't preserve the class of torsion-free sheaves. So this is really an action on some M sigma delta Chern character with a framing, which under a derived equivalence is sent to something which is Giesinger semi-stable. So CH prime and F prime under our relative Fourier-Mackay transform. But fortunately, we're in luck, and the corresponding cohomologies are isomorphic, and so cohomology of this moduli space is isomorphic to the cohomology of the Hilbert scheme. And so our action on cohomology is well-defined regardless of the chamber. On the other hand, our choice of isomorphism is actually extremely important. So the choice of an isomorphism is related to a path in the Kähler moduli space. So the Kähler moduli space is some exponential of complexified Kähler cone, who are going to avoid certain hyperplanes. Associated to this path, we can use the result of Halpern-Leisner, which was stated for K3 surfaces, but the construction is a tau local. It's all local to get a corresponding isomorphism between the cohomologies of K-theories. And this result actually gives us more than that. It actually gives us an isomorphism between the derived category from M sigma minus to the derived category of M sigma plus. And so given a particular choice of path, which is required to avoid certain walls, Halpern-Leisner's construction gives us an isomorphism between the cohomologies. So what are we going to do to define a three-loop algebra is we're just going to take a path to all possible chambers, and these will give us quantum toroidal algebras and various real single loop algebras, and we're just going to take the algebra that they all generate. Associated to a path in the Kähler moduli space, which is required to avoid certain hyperplanes, we just pick a path to each chamber, and in that chamber we naturally get an action of a quantum toroidal algebra. Let's say we start in the chamber corresponding to a Hilbert scheme. For each of these other chambers, we need to choose a path from that chamber to the other. Associated to that chamber, we get an action of a quantum toroidal algebra, and then we just take the associative algebra generated by all of these. In K-theory, this is going to be some version of like a triple loop algebra, which we'll just define according to this construction. And in cohomology, we'll define the Yangian of a double loop algebra, which is again some sort of UQ positive loops into G ADE double hat. We'll define it according to this construction as well. I guess the main result then is that this algebra, whatever it is, its structure is still somewhat mysterious, but we can prove that it controls the enumerative geometry of the surface. It turns out that rational curves in Lagrangian fibrations, similar to rational curves in conical symplectic singularities, are very well behaved. Let's start with a basic lemma or a proposition that if we have a Lagrangian fibration over an affine base B, then a rational curve or a stable rational curve, stable genus zero curve, has to lie entirely in a single singular fiber. And the proof of this is actually really quite simple. So there are no rational curves in affine varieties. And this implies that it lies in a single fiber. Our curve, the image of our curve sits inside of a singular fiber. And then there aren't any rational curves in abelian varieties, which implies that it's a singular fiber and not a smooth fiber. And the next thing we're going to do is study the Gromov-Witten invariants of these curve classes using intermediate symplectic singularities. So it's a by now fairly standard fact that if you take the usual Gromov-Witten invariants for particular curve classes alpha in n relative n1, then these are forced to vanish. So the there are obstructions so there are deformations of your Lagrangian fibration that make it so that your curve class doesn't remain of Hodge type. So of course there can be no algebraic curves of that type. And so therefore, if you want to do enumerative geometry, you do it with respect to a reduced class, which comes from a reduced perfect obstruction theory, which gives a different virtual fundamental class. So here's some various references about this fact. It's a well-studied phenomenon, so I only listed three references, but there's about a dozen papers or more that describe various details of the description of the reduced class. But what's important for us is related to this possibility of studying equivariant cohomology. And it turns out that if we can define equivariant invariants, all of our reduced obstruction theory maps are equivariant, and our reduction is also equivariant, and we get a relation between the usual virtual fundamental class and the reduced class, so that the equivariant class is just the H bar, which lives in the equivariant cohomology of the point, times the reduced class. So all of our invariants for non-zero degree are divisible by H bar, and what's left over after you do this division is the reduced class. Finally, there's a standard argument that says that actually most actual rational curves don't contribute still, but only certain curves, which in our case will turn out to be in bijection with roots in the, so we have an evaluation representation of a three-loop algebra corresponding to roots in a two-loop algebra. And the only contributions to the Gromov-Witten invariants come from curves that are associated with the root. So we get a bijection between curve classes, which give primitive contributions, and roots in the Lie algebra. Then finally, except for the curve that traces an elliptic curve, where it's corresponding analog of a curve that lives in a generic fiber, all of our push forward of two-point invariants, sorry, this should be two-point invariants actually embed into the quantum groups associated to intermediate symplectic singularities. So we get quantum groups associated to intermediate symplectic singularities. The two-point invariants, reduced invariants, embed into the corresponding quantum group. The two-point invariants govern the quantum differential equation. So there's a remarkable flat connection on the Kähler moduli space given by, well, we just take a logarithmic derivative with respect to a Novikov variable, and we subtract quantum multiplication by a divisor class. We have a WDVV equation in the equivariant case, which is flat to all orders of H bar. But in the case where there is no action, Oberdieck did the relevant calculation and showed that up to H bar squared, you still get a flat connection. I guess the main theorem is that we have a formula for this connection, which is a generalization of the formula of Malakhanov-Kunkov in the local case of quiver varieties. So we get the usual classical term of cut product. We have our evaluation push forward of our two-point invariants embeds into the quantum group, and it embeds in a particular form that we can understand on the intermediate symplectic singularities. And then there's this other term corresponding to that root that I believe also embeds quadratically into the quantum group. I know this in some examples, but in general, it's a work in progress to prove that this is true. And recall that H, so if we don't have a group action, this H bar is an infinitesimal parameter that squares to zero. Okay, so I guess this slide's not so important. It just says that this quantum differential equation isn't actually some formal thing. We can get some nice bounds and show that it converges to some analytic function. And for different chambers, we get different expansions of that formula. And we can ask about analytic continuation between the different choices. And it turns out that as long as we stay in the upper half plane, so we stay in the locus where the volume of our elliptic fiber is greater than zero and isn't negative, then we get an analytic continuation of all of these points with regular singularities. A finite number for each of an infinite number of walls that condense as you approach this hyperplane where the volume of your fiber tends to zero. So for each of these walls, the walls correspond to rational numbers with bounded denominator. So we have wall A over B, A and Z, B going from zero up to N. B goes from one to N. We get poles of order one and a finite number of roots of unity associated with each wall. So therefore, in the case where H bar is fine to all orders, we get this interesting flat connection with regular singularities in the upper half plane. And parallel to the local quiver case, we can actually understand the monodromy of this flat connection, but only in these cases. Okay, so there's some definition of monodromy over a base ring where h bar squared is equal to zero, but it's only really so interesting when you have an actual flat connection. And this corresponds to the cases that I described above in the main example, which are types A0, A1, A2, D4, and type E in various types. Okay, and that's all I wanted to say. So thank you for your attention.
All right, are there any questions?
Yeah, I have a ton of questions, actually.
Okay.
Maybe the first question is, so if we think about the case where we didn't have an elliptic vibration, but it was just usual ADE surface.
Okay.
Then the quantum group you find, it doesn't just involve the ADE roots. You get an extra piece coming from H0 of my surface.
Right, that's right.
So here you might expect an extra piece from H0 and H4.
So because we're only taking... So H4, our surface we're thinking of is like a non-compact. And so in the same way that for an ADE surface, ADE case, if you do either ordinary homology or Borel-Mohr homology in various dual pictures, for the non-compact case, you're only really going to get either the class corresponding to a point or the fundamental class. Mm-hmm. In H4.
Okay. I think you can probably see what I'm aiming for, because like when we were studying these similar three loop algebras, we found it was necessary to include some extra pieces to make it associative. And I'm wondering if this is where they come from.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so this might be related to, okay, so in the case of an elliptic surface, which is equivariant, then the class in H4 corresponding to, you know, the just fundamental class of the surface is H bar times the class of the elliptic curve. It's possible that it's related to this. I'll have to think about that.
So, I'm pretty sure that in the non-elliptic case, like the GL1 coming from H0 plays a similar role. It's kind of gravitational. Yeah, because it forms a W algebra, which is the symplectic symmetries of the plane, and the three-dimensional case, it should form the volume-preserving symmetries of three-dimensional geometry. I don't want to take up all your time, but I do have one more question, which is, again, in the non-elliptic case, it's natural to think of the whole story as being about the dt invariance of the Calabi-Yau threefold, where I take my surface times c.
Right.
Can I do that here too?
Yeah, so this, so we want to take maybe dt theory, but relative to certain divisors. So yeah, you want to take DT theory of maybe these S without the divisor at infinity times P1 relative, and we take relative invariance of this threefold relative to S minus D infinity times zero and S without D infinity times infinity. There may be a correction term. So in that case of a type ADE, or maybe even just type A, there's a direct relationship between the DT and PT theory of this surface and the Gromov-Witten invariance of the Hilbert scheme. At least for a K3 surface, there's a correction term. So it's possible that there's a correction gives the Gromov-Witten invariance of S without D infinity to N. This is well understood in the case of the K3 surface due to Overdijk, and Nesterov in either 2021 or 2022, maybe 2021. I'm not super sure. So I expect there to be a relationship. But in this case, there's going to be some sort of correction term, which is related to maybe quasi-maps to these surfaces.
In the case when things are equivariant, can I just say DT theory of S minus the divisor of infinity times C, because the equivariance will mean I don't care about the boundary term?
I'm not sure. I think you still get some sort of bubbling. So yeah, so if you take things, so in type, for example, I think even in type D and E, affine type D and E where our surface is a type D and E surface singularity. I think there may be even corrections terms in this case. I'm not entirely sure about what the correction term looks like. But even if you study things equivariantly, it's possible that there's still some sort of correction, but I'm not sure.
Are there other questions? Yeah, I don't want to hold everybody up. Would you have a few minutes to chat after the talk?
Sure, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so what would be like Samuel again, and maybe you and I can chat and people can leave if they want to. Okay.
All right. Everyone's questions get answered.